This show furnished by Dual Diagnosis Treatment Center.
Welcome to In Your Right Mind, a weekly discussion of behavioral health issues that affect our lives. We all have issues, so let's start talking.
Good evening and welcome to In Your Right Mind, a weekly radio show that discusses an array of behavioral health issues. We all have issues, so let's start talking. My name is Stephanie Wilder-Taylor.
And I'm Dr. Tanmay Sharma.
In this week's show, we're continuing our discussion about the unethical behavior and misconduct of government prosecutors and targeted attacks on innocent people. When it comes down to it, are we really a country where people are innocent until proven guilty?
This evening, we are joined by Mark Gotze, a professor of law at the University of Cincinnati, who was a former award-winning New York City federal prosecutor before he became a leading attorney and activist globally in the Innocence Project, the Ohio Innocence Project. And it protects innocent people who have been wrongly convicted. Welcome and thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Mark, in your book, Blind Injustice, you discuss real-world wrongful convictions and the psychological flaws inherent in the criminal justice system that have led to convictions of innocent people. Can you tell us more about this, about the message that you wanted to convey to people, and what is going on in the criminal justice system?
Yeah, well, I call the book Blind Injustice because the public is blind to the problems. I mean, I don't think anyone's really fully aware of how inaccurate and unjust our criminal justice system is. And even prosecutors and judges, they're sort of, you know, because I know this because I used to be a prosecutor, they're sort of bureaucrats, they become very smug in their positions, and just everyone just assumes that they're doing it right and getting it right without really being introspective or looking at what's actually happening. And, you know, I was that way too. Like the first chapter of the book is about how I was a prosecutor for my career and I became a law professor. The first school where I became a professor, they had an innocence project, and the guy who ran it was on sabbatical my first year. So the dean was sort of like, hey, you've got this criminal investigation background, you're going to have to do this. And as a prosecutor, my reaction was like, you got to be kidding me. You know, I didn't say this out loud, but in my head, I was like, you know, there's no innocent people in prison. And the first case that I was sort of forced to work on, we did DNA testing, and the guy ended up being innocent.
Wow.
And so I call that chapter Eye Opener. I had been very sarcastic toward the students who had worked on the case and everything. And so I spent that year really soul-searching and doing a lot of research and finding out about the innocence movement. And so the next year I got a job at the University of Cincinnati where I am now. And by that time I had completely gone through a conversion process. And so I founded the Ohio Innocence Project then in 2003. I'd become such a believer by then. And so far we've freed 25 innocent people in Ohio who served 470 years in prison for crimes they didn't commit. I wrote the book because there's a lot of different psychological factors going into it that I think, you know, really our criminal justice system is operating on an understanding of the human mind, on psychology from the 1800s or the 1950s at best. And there's many other parts of society that are catching up, but the criminal justice system isn't. And so awareness is just part of the problem.
So,
it's part of the solution.
Right. And so I want to concentrate on the psychology of this, and I know you've freed a lot of people, and that's wonderful, but we're trying to see why they were in prison in the first place. So I want to go back a little bit to the time that you were a prosecutor and explore with you the kind of mind of the prosecutor, that this whole thing about winning at any cost, in, you know, whether you have exculpatory evidence, whether you have various other things that are there that doesn't prove your case, you want to have those notches on your belt. And also to get some idea from you as to, are they doing this just because, you know, they feel that they're always right, or is it looking to the next private sector job or to be a judge?
Well, you know, first of all, the mentality in the prosecutor's offices is that they're always right, and I was always right, and everyone that we prosecuted and were preparing for trial against was clearly guilty. And human beings suffer from confirmation bias and tunnel vision. You know, confirmation bias is a big buzzword right now with politics, But I mean, it really, you can really see it very well in the criminal justice system. And because of our adversarial system where it's competitive, you know, you're in a war as a prosecutor. You're fighting against the defense attorney and you want to win. So I give several examples in my book of cases where I was a prosecutor and how the mind works where, you know, you're convinced that you're right. You're competitive. Your competitive juices are flowing. You want to win. You're the tough guy. And so as you're investigating, if evidence of innocence starts to surface, the human mind just sort of spins it in a way you don't really see it objectively. You know, any evidence that comes forward, you play a game in your mind. Okay, well, this guy's clearly guilty, so how can I explain this away? And then you come up with theories to sort of explain it away. And that often results in wrongful convictions because, you know, you go in as a prosecutor and you argue these theories to the jury. Really, all it is theories that the prosecutor made up. And they're not going to admit that they're wrong, and they're not going to admit that they have an innocent person. I don't think that prosecutors and police officers are sitting there trying to convict innocent people. It's not that at all. It's just the mentality, the bureaucratic mentality of just, we're always right. Everybody that's brought to us to prosecute is clearly guilty. They're the bad guys. We're the good guys. You know, we're not going to put up with their BS and their stupid arguments that defense attorneys make. And so with all the power that the state has, there's a very, you know, great inequality between the resources that a prosecutor has and a defense attorney has. It's very easy to turn that tunnel vision and that confirmation bias into convictions.
Right. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind, brought to you by Sovereign Health, and we're talking about flaws in our criminal justice system with Mark Godsey, a professor of law at the University of Cincinnati and leading attorney and activist who protects innocent people who have been wrongfully convicted.
And Mark, there is no recourse, essentially, that nobody ever gets punished. They have complete and absolute immunity. If they make up evidence, it doesn't really matter. Maybe a judge gets a little annoyed. That's it. And they move on and get their next promotion.
Well, you said maybe the judge gets a little annoyed. The judges are part of it.
Right.
I mean, most judges in this country are former prosecutors who have that same mentality.
Right.
And so, you know, there's supposed to be different branches, the judicial branch and the executive branch.
Yes.
They're supposed to be independent, but really they both sort of act like prosecutors in most instances. And you're exactly right. There's nobody, I mean, we've got cases in My Innocence Project where we have freed an innocent person, and through our investigation, we've identified who the true killer is or the true rapist. But the prosecutors all along were refusing to admit that they made a mistake. They were fighting the exoneration. And even after a court throws the case out and says, yeah, you developed pretty strong evidence that this other guy is the one who did it, they still won't admit a mistake, so they let the murderer just stay out on the street. They won't go arrest them.
Why won't they admit the mistake?
Well, I mean, I think it just goes back to the human mind again. They've dug their heels in from the very beginning of the case. You know, you've got these cases. When you go after somebody who was convicted of murder and they've been in prison for 20 years, like in one of my cases, the prosecutor who originally convicted that guy 20 years ago, you know, has the front page of the paper framed in his office. That's like his big trophy. That's the case of his career. And so he's been proud of that for 20 years. And so you try to come back to him later and say, hey, this guy's actually innocent. This is just human behavior. This is what they do. Very few people, when there's that much personal incentive involved, will be objective and say, oh, man, I should maybe really look at this objectively. Instead, they go, what are you talking about? And they immediately, in a knee-jerk reaction, fight back. And then the more they do that, the more they dig in and dig in through the litigation, and they convince themselves. I mean, I talk about this in the book Blind Injustice. I give plenty of examples from my innocence cases where prosecutors, you know, take these ridiculous positions in cases and, you know, just these unbelievable, try to explain away, you know, a common thing in the innocence movement is, you know, there'll be a case where a woman was raped and she went to the hospital and a rape kit was taken. They collect semen from the perpetrator and she identifies someone and they go to trial and the guy's convicted and she testifies. It's very clear that there was one man who attacked her and raped her. And the guy always says he's innocent. So finally he gets DNA testing after he's been in prison for 20 years and the DNA comes back and it clears him. It's not him. And so the prosecutors, instead of accepting the truth, we're looking at the case objectively, they'll say, oh, well, the victim must have been wrong. She must have been attacked by two guys. And so the other guy's the one who ejaculated and left the semen. And the defendant's still guilty. He just didn't leave any of his DNA at the crime scene. And it's
right.
Like, what are you talking about? 20 years ago, you argued that there was one person and the evidence was absolutely clear. You know, so it's that sort of thing over and over again.
They'll make things up just to suit their case. When they know
exactly.
That they were
wrong. There's nobody, you know, like in my case where we identified, there's a couple of them, we identified who the true perpetrator was. They're still on the street, because the prosecutor doesn't want to admit a mistake, and you know, there's nobody there to make them do it.
Because they have such an emotional involvement, such a high emotional involvement in the victories that they're notching
exactly
up on
right.
their belt.
Exactly right.
You talk about the cognitive dissonance and the confirmation bias, but isn't there times where there's irrefutable evidence that the person is innocent, and then what do you do as a prosecutor if you're knee-deep in this case? I mean, do you just kind of turn that off in your mind?
I think they just turn it off. I mean, I can give an example. In the case of Clarence Elkins, he was convicted of murdering his mother-in-law and raping his six-year-old niece. What happened is, in the middle of the night, the mother-in-law's home was broken into, and she was raped and murdered. And the niece was spending the night with her grandma. She was 6 years old, and she was attacked as well and left for dead and raped. Fortunately, she survived, and she only saw the attacker in the dark for a few seconds before she was knocked unconscious, so it wasn't a very good ID, but she said it was her Uncle Clarence. Anybody who studies eyewitness identification will know that's not a very reliable, you know, given the darkness and the stress of the situation. But they sought the death penalty against Clarence, and he was convicted. Years later, we did DNA testing of the grandmother's vaginal cavity, and it came back with male DNA that was not Clarence Elkins's, and, you know, she was not sexually active. That was undisputed. Then we did testing of the little girl's underwear. The perpetrator knocked her unconscious and removed her underwear, and so we found skin cells on the underwear band, the elastic band where he removed the underwear, and it was the same man's DNA, the same DNA profile from the grandmother and the little girl, and it was not Clarence. So that clearly shows there's only one man's DNA could be in both of the victims that night, and that's
right.
The perpetrator. And so what they said was this. I mean, this is how ridiculous it gets. Well, Judy Johnson, the grandmother, you know, maybe she shook hands or had some very close encounter with a male on the day when she was murdered, and then she went home and she touched herself or masturbated and she rubbed off the man's DNA inside of her, and then she helped the six-year-old go to the bathroom, and that man's DNA rubbed off on the underwear of the little girl. You know, just these, and it's like a six-year-old doesn't need help going to the bathroom.
Right.
And scientifically, if you shake hands with a man and then touch yourself, you're not going to rub his DNA off down inside your vagina. And so, and I sat there, and this is what made me write the book, because that was one of my first cases, and I'm like, this guy is arguing this in court, and he actually believes it. And I was like, is he lying for politics? Does he actually believe this? This is bizarre. And the more I started doing these cases, I was like, they actually believe this. They actually, they're so invested in it psychologically that they will make up any story to avoid admitting that they made a mistake and they left the true perpetrator.
That's
out.
Insane. Well, we need to go to a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk more about this, about prosecutorial misconduct and the wrongly accused, with Mark Godsey, a professor of law at the University of Cincinnati, and more guests later on in the show. You're listening to In Your Right Mind, brought to you by Sovereign Health. We'll be right back.
Don't lose sight on finding the best help for your son or daughter.
It was impossible, it seemed, to have him at home. We didn't know what to do. We were at a loss.
Sovereign Health's adolescent program offers treatment for males and females of ages 12 through 17 struggling with addiction, mental health, and co-occurring conditions.
Someone recommended Sovereign Health. We went down there and met the people, and that's what really did it for me. Everybody there seemed really not just kind. They didn't seem like they were there just punching the clock. They seemed like they were really caring about, and they cared about the dilemma that we were in.
Let us help you and your family heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has unique qualities and meets your loved one's treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
News, talk, evolve. Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Welcome back to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. I'm Stephanie Wilder-Taylor. We're talking about prosecutorial misconduct and restoring justice to the criminal justice system with Mark Godsey, author of Blind Injustice, who protects innocent people who have been wrongly convicted.
Mr. Godsey, I wanted to come back to the time that you were a prosecutor, because that explores the, I'm interested in the mind, and I've done quite a lot of research on the brain as well. So the sort of bureaucratic, the fog of bureaucratic denial that you've talked about, and being a prosecutor's prosecutor, the kind of things that happen, for example, cutting corners, ignoring police misconduct, or the mm-hmm. misconduct by the FBI, and skewing forensics. These are the kind of, why do you think from a psychological perspective that they are, okay, somebody's invested in something, but can you not say, okay, this just doesn't add up? Why are they going for the victory at any cost?
Well, it's a couple of things. I mean, and you know, I was very much immersed in this as a prosecutor. There's very much sort of like a team identification thing going on where, you know, you're part of law enforcement, you're working with the police, you're working with other prosecutors, you're all very proud, you're the good guys, you're getting the bad guys off the street, you sort of feel like you're at war, and so there's this camaraderie that develops between everybody in law enforcement. It makes it, you feel good about that. You know, anytime you identify with a team, that builds self-esteem, it makes you feel like you're part of something special. And so that also just feeds into the competitiveness, and it becomes very sort of like us against them. You know, and then as a prosecutor or even a police officer, when you're winning the big cases, that's how you move up. That's how you get promoted. And you know, the tougher the case is to win, if you can actually win a case like that, that's even more of a feather in your cap, because you look like this magician that pulled a rabbit out of a hat.
Mm-hmm.
So the ones where they look innocent, if you can win those, that's even better. That means you're a heck of a prosecutor. And so you get in a bubble. You get in this echo chamber where you're just around other people who are also prosecutors, who are also law enforcement. You're on the same team. You're all doing the same thing. You're convinced that everybody's guilty. You're convinced that you're the good guys. And so in that mentality and that environment, it doesn't seem as bad. I call it in the book Noble Cause Corruption. You feel like you're going after this noble cause to get the bad guys off the street. It's like Robin Hood. You know, you're stealing from the rich and giving to the poor. If you cut a little corners here and there, we're the good guys. We're going after a noble cause. You know, that's okay, because it's up to us to protect the public, and nobody wants to get a murderer off on something stupid, so let's cut a few corners. And that's not an illogical, if you're in that environment, that's not an illogical thing to conclude. I mean, you know, there's surveys about if you could go back in time, if you had a time machine, how many of you would go assassinate Hitler when he was a baby? And the numbers who say I would do that are very high, like 80%. Because it's, you know, murder's not a good thing, but you're helping a greater public good is what people think when they answer that question. And so it's a very similar thing. When you're in that team mentality and you think you're at war and you're the good guys against the bad guys and you're always right, it becomes very tempting not to, in some instances, cut corners to make sure that, you know, your noble cause is being effectuated.
But most of the time, prosecutors are not going to trial. They are doing deals. They're mm-hmm. saying, okay, you'll get 50 years for this. If you do a plea, you'll get 3 years or 5 years.
Yeah. You know, the plea system in America, we're so used to it, we don't realize how barbaric it seems. I mean, I speak on the innocence movement all over the world. I've been on pretty much every continent and all over Europe. And almost everywhere I go, people from other countries think of the American plea bargaining system as just absolutely barbaric, as something like when we would look on the criminal justice system, like in the Congo or something, a third world country. But, you know, we're so used to it, it's like a stain on the furniture that you don't see anymore. But because of all the mandatory minimums and the way that we've just gotten out of control with mass incarceration and extremely high penalties, it's transferred a great amount of power to prosecutors, where for, you know, minor crimes in some instances, they can indict in a way to stack on just years and years and years and years and years. And then they can dangle in front of you some, you know, minor sentence if you plead guilty, and a logical person can become convinced, even if they're innocent, that, you know, this is my only opportunity to have a life is to take this deal. But the plea bargaining system has gotten out of control, and it's viewed as, you know, an atrocity in many other places around the world.
Do you ever think that it's money motivated, that sometimes you know, they're going after a person or a company and just hoping that they'll make a deal so that they can pay a lot of money?
In my experience, I didn't really see money. It was more power and promotions and career benefits and things like that. I mean, I do remember one case where, I mean, this isn't really money, but, you know, there's the ability in drug cases to do forfeiture. So if a car is used in the drug deal and you arrest them doing the drug deal in the car, you might be able to take the car away from them. And there was a particular case where I remember the DEA saying, hey, this guy's got a really sweet car. It's all pimped out. It'd be perfect to do undercover deals in. Like, we really want that car. So they waited until the guy did the deal in the car to arrest him so they could take his car. So that's like one example.
Right.
But for the most part, it's just the competitive nature of people wanting to advance and look good and be the star of their office,
right,
both prosecutors and police officers.
But they're looking at their next step, whether they're going to be a judge or get a seven-figure salary as a private, you know, in some private company.
Right, or, you know, end up being the DA themselves.
Elections
drive a lot of this. I mean, elected judges, elected prosecutors, you know, in this mentality, you've got to always look tough on crime. You've got to sort of reflect this testosterone laced hard ass approach that, you know, you're tough on crime, and it almost becomes like sort of competitive. You know, I was recently asked to be on a task force hiring a prosecutor, and I think I was asked to do it just because of my affiliation with the Innocence Project, so they looked sort of like they were, you know, being diverse on the task force. And I was on it with a bunch of prosecutors, and they were coming in, introducing themselves and doing, you know, the firm handshake with listing all their credentials at the beginning. And I had been out of that world for so long, it just sort of struck me again as to, you know, how show off.
Yeah, the kind of macho-ness of it.
Macho-ness, yeah.
Yes.
And,
I wanted to ask you something that is not in your book, that racism. It's,
yeah, sure.
It's not in your book, but your book is about racism.
Well, yeah, I mean, it actually doesn't mention racism. In the opening chapter, I say that I'm not going to discuss it. It's about all these different psychological phenomena, like, you know, confirmation bias, and malleable memory, and different things like that contribute to wrongful convictions.
Yes.
But, you know, I said at the beginning, I've got a note that I'm not going to talk about racism, and that's interesting, or might raise some eyebrows, because that's a huge problem in our criminal justice system, but it's such a loaded term.
Yeah, I understand that people switch off. Sorry to interrupt you, but I know that people switch off when you talk about racism as such. But it's all loaded in terms of all of this. You see a certain person of a certain ethnicity with a certain type of car, and there are feelings and emotions that come up, or certain kinds of house. So I know that you wanted to avoid that, and then people would just switch off, say, oh, yeah, another book on racism. Yeah, we know that already. We know the stats of how many people are locked up that are of different color. But I wanted to still explore that to say, well, how does it come into it, along with confirmation bias, along with all of the things that psychologically make them delusional, essentially?
I'm going to let Mark answer that question, but I want to remind everybody that if you're just tuning in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind. It's brought to you by Sovereign Health. And Mark Gotze wrote the book Blind Injustice, and he's answering our questions today.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so, I mean, the book talks about these different psychological factors. Like I said, does not address racism. And in the end, I wanted people to finish and say, I've actually learned about racism, because racism, the building blocks of racism are these same psychological factors. Revisionist history, memory, confirmation bias, tunnel vision, because it's exactly right. I mean, I don't think the full extent to which people fully realize the extent to which these sort of preconceived notions about race and economics and different things like that influence what they see and how they interpret what they see. And so if you can really help people understand how confirmation bias works in the human mind, how tunnel vision helps us twist what we're seeing without even realizing that it's happening, I think people can better understand the arguments of people who are trying to explain racism to the public when they're not fully accepting it.
Yeah, and also I think another psychological concept that is important is sort of dehumanization. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, yeah, that's one of the chapters. I mean, I talk about that in the book in great detail. When I was a prosecutor, we dehumanized quite a bit. And to some extent, you have to. When you're inflicting punishment on people, if you sit there and think about them as human beings, it's extremely painful. And, you know, police and prosecutors have to send these people to prison. But it just goes too far. And I tell a story of of, you know, how after we got convictions, we would party and celebrate. And, you know, their family, the people we convicted might be in the courtroom crying because their lives have been destroyed and we're high-fiving. And I think that's just symptomatic of how when you're a bureaucrat and you're a prosecutor and you're going through these things, you sort of lose your humanity a little bit and you sort of go through the motions and think of it as like you're playing a Monopoly game. And I now that I'm on the other side and dealing with innocent people, I see how many of the prosecutors that we're opposing in these cases are just conditioned not to consider the human aspect. They don't really care about the injustice they're creating because they're conditioned not to even think about those things.
Well, Mark Godsey, the book is Blind Injustice, and I'm going to let you go, get back to your family, but I want to thank you for your time. We have to go to a break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking to Reddy Annaparetti, who is a victim of federal misconduct, and Joshua Greenberg, a Washington, D.C. lawyer who represented him in the retrial. You're listening to In Your Right Mind, brought to you by Sovereign Health. We'll be right back.
Don't lose sight on finding the best help for your son or daughter.
It was impossible, it seemed, to have him at home. We didn't know what to do. We were at a loss.
Sovereign Health's adolescent program offers treatment for males and females of ages 12 through 17 struggling with addiction, mental health, and co-occurring conditions.
Someone recommended Sovereign Health. We went down there and met the people, and that's what really did it for me. Everybody there seemed really not just kind. They didn't seem like they were there just punching the clock. They seemed like they were really caring about him. They cared about the dilemma that we were in.
Let us help you and your family heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has unique qualities and meets your loved one's treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com. Nearly half of all Americans experience at least one mental illness at some point in their lives. Sovereign Health offers treatment programs for a large spectrum of issues, including depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress disorder, and eating disorders. Let us help you heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has your unique qualities and meets your treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-764-6570. That's 866-764-6570. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
Talk Radio 790, KABC News Update. I'm Steve Cumming. A spokesman for Special Counsel Robert Mueller has confirmed that a top FBI counterintelligence agent was removed from the Russia investigation following allegations that he sent text messages critical of President Trump to a colleague. The removal of the agent, who had also worked on the investigation of Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server, occurred this summer. Consumers and retailers won big over the five-day shopping holiday last week.
The National Retail Federation says that more than 174 million Americans shopped in stores and online from Thanksgiving through Cyber Monday. That's 10 million more than the 164 million estimated shoppers from the group's earlier survey. The biggest spenders were older millennials aged 25 to 34, and the most popular day for in-store shopping was Black Friday. I'm Mike Ramirez.
KABC SoCal weather, mostly clear this evening, lows in the lower to mid-50s. More news coming up and continuous coverage on KABC.com. I'm Steve Cumming, Talk Radio 790, KABC News.
Welcome back to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. I'm Stephanie Wilder-Taylor. We've been talking about prosecutorial misconduct, and we are joined by a few more guests right now.
We are joining us this evening is Vijay Reddy Annaparetti, a successful Indian American entrepreneur and a pharmacist from Baltimore, Maryland, who once owned a pharmacy delivery business that stretched across six states. He was named Entrepreneur of the Year for the state of Maryland in 2013. But the next day, he was raided by the FBI for alleged healthcare fraud.
And we're also joined by Joshua Greenberg, a Washington, D.C.-based lawyer and founder of the Joshua Greenberg Firm, a firm that focuses on white-collar criminal defense, civil litigation, and appeals, who represented Reddy in his retrial.
So let me welcome both of you to the show.
Hello.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Sharma.
I just want to lay the scene out so that we don't spend a long time on the background. We in this show want to talk about, you know, when Mr. Greenberg, you came into the picture and then what happened thereafter. So for our listeners, I just want to lay out the background that in July of 2013, a federal grand jury in Maryland had indicted Mr. Reddy on charges that he had built Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance insurers out of millions of dollars by submitting fraudulent billings for prescription filled by pharmacies that he owned in Maryland and Washington. We also know that some of his employees had pleaded guilty in the previous segments of the show. We had discussed with a former prosecutor as to how these plea bargainings kind of happen. So we are aware that these things, you don't have to prove anything. People take deals all the time. However, after that, there was things changed, and Mr. Greenberg, you came onto the picture. I want to ask Mr. Reddy, what caused you to, you know, look at a new firm of lawyers?
I went to the jury trial, Dr. Sharma, and I found guilty, which I should not have found guilty.
Right.
And when I got convicted, I know I did not do this crime, so why I was convicted? I could not take it. So I was trying to ask my trial lawyer, what should we do now? And he was keeping quiet, so I could not keep quiet. And so I searched on the internet and I found, my two attorneys.
Okay, but so Mr. Greenberg, from your perspective, when you saw, you're taking on this case that has already had a jury verdict, what were your thoughts?
Well, I mean, it was an extremely difficult situation. I mean, Mr. Annaparetti had already been found guilty. He was 4 or 5 weeks away from sentencing, and he was facing 12 years in prison, followed by deportation. It's extremely unusual to get a guilty verdict overturned, even on appeal, and to do it in the district court before sentencing is unheard of.
Yes.
But we had a strategy here, and that was analyzing the government's multi-million-dollar loss calculation, which it said the lead prosecutor, Sandra Wilkinson, told the jury that was the most significant evidence in the case. That's what she said in her rebuttal closing argument. And working with experts and analyzing the data, we determined that the loss calculation was entirely false, and there's actually no loss whatsoever. So the most important evidence in the case was false, and that was sort of the springboard for the motion for a new trial. That was, the lead argument. And then, we learned a lot more about the government's misconduct and what had gone on and, uncovered just egregious acts by the prosecutors and agents that
Mr. Mr. Annaparetti not guilty, that there was an excess of, I don't know, maybe Medicare owed him money instead of him bilking the government of all these millions of dollars that I think it was Mary Hammond, who was the government auditor who came and kept on changing her mind?
Well, I mean, the case was based on false evidence. I mean, the reason that Mr. Annaparetti was found guilty is because, as Judge Russell ultimately found, the government presented material false evidence on three critical subjects. One was the loss calculations. Another one was a supposed absence of a phone call by Mr. Annaparetti in response to an email that the government said was incriminating and they used as a basis for a jury instruction, saying that telling the jury that silence was an admission and they told the jury that that Mr. Annapredi never called the employee who sent the email, and that was false. He called him, I believe, five times. About an hour after the email.
So the third category
is probably the one that really made the biggest difference, and that was the fact that the lead prosecutor, Sandra Wilkinson, met in a conference room in the U.S. Attorney's office in Baltimore with the other prosecutor, Kathy Pascal, and several agents, and ordered the destruction of four boxes of exculpatory documents out of hundreds while Mr. Annapredi's motion for a new trial was pending. And, you know, we didn't learn about that until August 19th, 2016, and it just so happened that one of the agents wrote a memo about it, and that was as much of a smoking gun as you could imagine.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind, brought to you by Sovereign Health, and we're talking about prosecutorial misconduct with Reddy Annapredi, a successful Indian-American entrepreneur and pharmacist, and Washington, D.C.-based lawyer Joshua Greenberg. Do you think, you know, we had a guest on in the first segment of the show that talked about how prosecutors twist things in their mind, even if it looks like a person might be not guilty, to convince themselves of the guilt. But do you think in this case that they were actually, you know, destroying evidence on purpose because they saw that Mr. Annapredi was not guilty?
Well, I mean, the facts speak for themselves. I mean, Ms. Wilkinson ordered the destruction of four boxes out of hundreds. Those four boxes contained delivery signature logs, which go to the whole issue in the case, was whether Mr. Annapredi's business, PharmaCare, was delivering the expensive prescriptions for which it was billing government insurance programs. And why did she order the destruction of those four boxes out of hundreds while his motion for a new trial was pending? I mean, you know, without those documents, it's impossible for Mr. Annapredi to prove that he's innocent. Those documents show that the patients got this, the very medications that the government alleged were never received, and the very medications, the very prescriptions and refills that the government told the jury were part of a massive fraud, a multi-million-dollar fraud.
How did you find out that she destroyed that evidence?
Kept making requests for information, kept pushing, and really just was aggressively going after what happened to these documents, what was, you know, it was really like pulling teeth to get information from these prosecutors. You know, we had to file motions to compel, and that's how we got the information showing that they had internal documents that showed that the multimillion-dollar loss calculation was false and that there was actually a surplus. They had those documents before the trial. And with respect to the destruction of the documents, you know, we kept making requests, and eventually happened to be on my birthday, I was having dinner with my family, and get this email from the lead prosecutor with a whole bunch of attachments, and I was looking at it, I was like, well, what is this? And I opened it, and I saw that one of the attachments was this half-page memo by an agent about the destruction of documents. And it's because I kept asking, you know, where are the delivery signature logs? How many were there? You know, I kept asking questions, and eventually, I guess they were forced to disclose this memo. Which was just shocking. I mean, I've just never, you know, I've talked to a number of former federal prosecutors about this issue. No one's heard of a prosecutor ordering the destruction of evidence in a pending case, let alone such important evidence that's exculpatory. I mean, it's really just shocking. And so we found out just by, you know, by being thorough, by being aggressive, by being persistent, and, you know, not letting up and not letting the government just get away with not answering questions, and, you know, just that's really all there was to it, is, you know, being tenacious.
We need to go to a break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking more with Reddy Annapredi about when prosecutors wrongly accuse and convict people of crimes they didn't commit, and how he fought back with Joshua Greenberg. Thank God he found you, Mr. Greenberg, who is a Washington, D.C.-based lawyer who represented Reddy in the retrial effort. You're listening to In Your Right Mind, brought to you by Sovereign Health. We'll be right back.
Nearly half of all Americans experience at least one mental illness at some point in their lives. Sovereign Health offers treatment programs for a large spectrum of issues, including depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress disorder, and eating disorders. Let us help you heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has your unique qualities and meets your treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-764-6570. That's 866-764-6570. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
Are you or a loved one suffering from an eating disorder? At Sovereign Health, we believe these brain diseases that strain people's lives should not define them. Let us help you heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has your unique qualities and meets your treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
Roughly 100 million Americans suffer from chronic pain. This problem is not only excruciating, but it also takes a hit on the individual's relationships with others. Here at Sovereign Health's Chronic Pain Program, our experts target and treat the underlying causes of the problem, while also helping our patients discover the best pain reduction methods that work for them. Let us help you heal. Call Sovereign Health at 866-764-6570. That's 866-764-6570. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
Don't lose sight on finding the best help for your son or daughter.
It was impossible, it seemed, to have him at home. We didn't know what to do. We were at a loss.
Sovereign Health's adolescent program offers treatment for males and females of ages 12 through 17 struggling with addiction, mental health, and co-occurring conditions.
Someone recommended Sovereign Health. We went down there and met the people, and that's what really did it for me. Everybody there seemed really not just kind. They didn't seem like they were there just punching the clock. They seemed like they were really caring about him. They cared about the dilemma that we were in.
Let us help you and your family heal in a safe, nurturing environment with an individualized treatment plan that has unique qualities and meets your loved one's treatment needs. Call Sovereign Health at 866-224-7297. That's 866-224-7297. Or visit us online at sovhealth.com.
Home of the smartest listeners in Southern California. Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Welcome back to In Your Right Mind with Dr. Tanmoy Sharma. I'm Stephanie Wilder-Taylor. We're talking with Reddy Annapuretti, a successful Indian-American entrepreneur and pharmacist from Baltimore, Maryland, who was wrongly accused and how he fought back, and Joshua Greenberg, a Washington, D.C.-based lawyer who represented him in the retrial.
Mr. Greenberg, the second prong of the argument of the Department of Justice and the prosecutors was that they was about phone records and Mr. Annapuretti not responding back to an email. Tell us a little bit more.
Yes. The government, and especially the lead prosecutor, Sandra Wilkinson, made a huge deal at trial about an email that was sent by a pharmacy technician that Ms. Wilkinson claimed showed the template for the supposed fraud. There was no fraud, but she claimed that this email showed a scheme to bill for very expensive medications such as HIV and psychiatric, and then have them return the stock and then not reverse the claims to government insurance programs so that the payments still went through, but then to not reverse the claims for inexpensive medications for the same patients, which doesn't make any sense. I mean, why would anybody do that? It doesn't even, and they had, I think, if I remember correctly, something like five examples of that in the trial. That was it. But she claimed that this was their scheme, and this was the template. And her argument to the court, to Judge Russell, was that, oh, well, Mr. Annaparetti got this email, and he didn't even respond, so that's, you know, he's admitting it's true. I'm admitting her interpretation of the email is true, first of all. But second of all, it was false that he didn't respond. I mean, he made something like 5 phone calls within about an hour after receiving that email, and he was, and when he finally got a hold of the pharmacy technician, he was like, what are you talking about? And, you know, and looked into this and had the guy call the insurers to try to fix the problem. And it was just not, you know, it was simply not true what the prosecutor was saying, and she actually got a jury instruction based on that. I mean, imagine you're a federal judge, you're relying on the prosecutors to tell you the truth, you're giving a jury instruction based on something they're saying, and they didn't even have the phone records, and they offered testimony by the case agent to the jury that she had reviewed all the phone records and there was no phone call. That was false. And that was something I think that really bothered Judge Russell, and he made a big point of it at the hearing, and even, you know, throughout the word perjury in the hearing when he dismissed the case. So it was really inexplicable. I mean, it's the most basic thing. I mean, FBI agents subpoena phone records all the time. I mean, it makes no sense that they, you know, miss this. And, yeah, I mean, it's really just beyond belief.
When you were contacted by Mr. Annaparetti, how long did it take you to look through? I mean, this must have looked bad to you when you looked at it, and he'd already been said to be guilty. How long did it take you to start figuring out that you had a case?
Within a couple of months, I guess. With, you know, the issues with the data became apparent, and the fact that the loss calculations were false became apparent, and, you know, I filed a brief demonstrating the multimillion-dollar loss calculation was false. That was when I knew there was false evidence, but the misconduct wasn't discovered. Well, the first part of the misconduct came to light in the fall of 2015, or at least the first concrete evidence of it, when, after having to file a motion to compel the government to produce their internal documents with calculations about the loss, they finally produced documents. They had a team of experts working on these loss calculations, and the team of experts found results that were directly opposite to what they had their in-house auditor present at trial. She said there was a $4.5 million loss. The in-house the team of experts, their calculations found no loss, even a surplus. And they withheld these documents. They should have been produced. There's a famous case called Brady that requires the government to produce evidence that's favorable to the defense. And it's hard to imagine evidence that's more favorable to the defense than evidence that shows that the most significant evidence in the government's case in chief is false. And they withheld that. And we only got it after the judge granted a motion to compel in October 2015. And then the other two main major categories of misconduct we didn't learn about until the summer of 2016. And again, that was in response to repeated requests for documents and information from the prosecutors. And I was finally able to pin them down. And I guess they felt they had no choice but to produce this information about the destruction of the documents and the phone records, and they had no answer. I mean, they couldn't explain what happened without finally revealing the truth. And, you know, these kinds of revelations, even one of these things in the case would be extraordinary. To have is just unbelievable. Yeah. And then, you know, even within the three categories, there's many more pieces to unpack that, you know, it would take too long in this interview. But so it's just really sort of a stunning array of misconduct.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In Your Right Mind, brought to you by Sovereign Health. We're having a fascinating discussion about prosecutorial misconduct with Reddy Annaparetti, a successful Indian-American entrepreneur and pharmacist, and Washington, D.C.-based lawyer Joshua Greenberg.
So, Mr. Greenberg, the because prosecutors know that they have absolute immunity and nothing happens to them, there is, even if there is a semblance of an internal investigation, even when they have perjured themselves, they have made up evidence or decided that somebody was guilty and lied, they know that there is no consequence. So does this absolute immunity, do you feel that this absolute immunity that they have, you know, make them take liberties with the truth? And because the victory is important, Mr. Annaparedi was the entrepreneur of, oh, look, we took down this big guy who was the entrepreneur of the year in Maryland.
Well, I definitely think there's, the Supreme Court cases and absolute immunity are a real problem. I mean, prosecutors have absolute immunity for prosecutorial acts, and they know that. So, and apart from that, I mean, even, and that's, you know, immunity from civil lawsuits doesn't give them immunity from criminal prosecution. But, I mean, putting aside that, there is an internal disciplinary process for prosecutors, and the problem with that is it's done in secret, and it rarely results in any meaningful consequences.
Oh, nothing at all, including in the Enron cases. I know that Enron had a problem.
So prosecutors, I mean, first of all, I will say that, you know, most prosecutors out there are good people. I mean, what happened in Mr. Annaparedi's case, you know, I think this kind of thing does happen and escapes notice in many cases, but the vast majority of prosecutors are out there are good people. But there are some that really are bad and they cheat. And that's what happened in this case. And I do think that when there's a high-profile target, someone whose business is growing very rapidly and is very successful, a lot of prosecutors are willing to bend the rules to try to bring that person down and get a nice press release.
And if I may jump in.
Sure. Go ahead.
If you don't fit the profile, if you are not normal, if you don't look like them, that could be one of the reasons these prosecutors, that's what happened, I think, my prosecutor thought I could. I don't know
so
if I'm putting it in the right way or not.
Ms. Annaparedi, do you want to define what you mean by normal?
Because if I'm a white guy, probably I would not have been raided to begin with. I'm not trying to be racist or anything, but I think my prosecutor was racist.
Right. Well, tell us a little bit more about what makes you say that.
I don't know. That's how I feel, because why would a prosecutor cheat? Why would a prosecutor, you know, like you mentioned earlier in the story,
sure,
I and anybody else of this level are like a trophies for them, like they win a PGA tournament.
Yes.
That's it. So they want to win at any cost. See, you could prosecute, you could present the right evidence, but not by threatening people, by not falsifying the evidence, not by, you know, you can't imagine on a daily basis FBI agent coming on stand and lying to the jury.
Right.
It doesn't happen. Why would they do that? Why would they go to that level?
Right.
They destroyed my life. I'm on the streets. Lost $70 million. And what did they get? Nothing.
And you have no recourse essentially against them. You might have recourse against, you know, other people, but no recourse against them. They know that they are completely immune,
so they can
do what they want.
Yeah, they can. Probably, you know, if I'm a normal, you know, person like them, probably they would. I don't know. That's how I feel. I'm not saying that.
Sure.
It could be true or not true. I don't know.
Well,
that's
we wanted to know your feelings, and we wanted to know how it affected you. From you build this up as an entrepreneur from zero, as I understand it, and then to have it all destroyed and taken away. What kind of I think I read somewhere that you've taken some pills and you drank some whiskey. You obviously wanted to end your life.
No, I mean, yeah, I tried to take my life. The reason is, you know, I had a $17 million life insurance, and I was thinking, you know what, I built this company, this is like my baby, and
yes,
the only way my company can survive now is I have to have $4-5 million cash in hand so my business can survive.
Right.
So I thought, you know, even if I go, if my business can survive, I would have like, 110 employees. I was feeding 110 employees every month.
Right.
And I said, the business will continue.
Right.
So I thought, that $17 million would not only keep my company alive, but I thought my wife and kids would have some money because I never saved any money. I put every single dollar in my business to grow.
Well, wow. It's obviously, we have no words as to how we could, I'm absolutely flabbergasted.
This was such an important show, and I want to thank you so much for coming on here and telling your story, Reddy. And I think we need to thank your attorney, too, Joshua Greenberg. Thank you for your time and coming on the show, and I also want to thank our previous guest, Mark Godsey. Don't forget to tune in next Sunday at 5 p.m. for a new episode of In Your Right Mind. And if you like what you hear, you can download this edition of In Your Right Mind as a podcast by going to iTunes or visit inyourrightmind.com to hear this show or previous episodes. Thank you again. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.
This show furnished by Dual Diagnosis Treatment Center.